All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Doomer Optimism. I am here. Patrick will be joining. And I'm here with Andy and Keturah in a new video setup. So, those of you watching on YouTube, I'm just in a tiny little corner of this video screen, but it's fine. Okay. So, basically, the theme of what we want to talk about today is I think reflecting a little bit on Andy and Keturah being early on in their relationship and trying to think about where they want to settle and make a life. And I think somewhat rightly disillusioned by the state of the United States. And then me and Patrick, when he joins, are kind of on the far end of we were disillusioned early on and still are. But we were disillusioned, strongly disillusioned early on in our relationship with the state of the United States. And, in early on in our marriage, even before we had kids, we decided to move outside of the United States. We spent 7 years in Uruguay. Now we're back in the US. So I think, like, just kind of ruminating broadly on where to settle. And it's not a very straightforward question. And I'm ambivalent. I'm totally ambivalent still about the trade-offs where you settle. So let's just start with that as an intro, and then let's get your thoughts, and then we'll just kind of make it a conversation.
Well, I think the thing that should be said before anything else is that let nobody accuse me of not being a patriot. I like this country. I love it. I've seen more of this country than most people probably have. I've gotten to know her on a more intimate level than many get the privilege to do. And I do love America, and I do love the idea of America, particularly as it manifested in the pre-World War II, all the history basically up until World War II, there was still something going on here. It was tar paper shacks and moonshine, and you had a high level of agency as a free citizen in this country. And then I think after World War II, the kind of human monoculture rolled out, where the military mentality that got us through World War II came to the home front. And then we sort of crafted this incredibly normative culture, where everybody's policing on each other and tattletaling. And if you don't do things in the way that we invented in the last 40 years, we're going to call the government in on you, and you're going to be under siege, and we're going to break up your family because you ain't playing the game. Right. And you see examples like Ruby Ridge in 92, and Waco, and these different events that happen where the feds will come down on you hard for not behaving as you're expected to behave. They want to manage American citizens as tax cattle, and all of the frontier history be damned. And that hurts my heart. And at a certain point, I look at it and I say, well, I've loved this country and hope to change it by writing, or find a part of it that is free by traveling, or even try to start things by trying to convince people to move up to this place, which is so cheap and kind of off the grid, and nothing's really taken. So at a certain point, how long am I supposed to piss up a long rope to try to make this country better? That's my question.
And just so Pat is up to date, we're just talking.
Hey, good morning, Andy. Hey,
good morning,
Keturah.
Pat. Great to see you, my friend.
The daylight savings sucked.
Yes, I
theme
agree.
of this conversation is basically, we're on the far end of having been disillusioned with the United States, moved out of the US, and now we're back. But we're
I'm
ambivalent
just
about
as disillusioned as ever,
it.
but I am here.
And so this is the main question. I guess where to actually put your roots down, where to actually settle, and just go ahead on some of your feelings about this, or we
This
can talk.
unprompted?
Yeah, how about
I
what?
thought this was like a Q&A.
Okay, how about it's a conversation. How about what were we thinking when we left? A lot of people ask us this, so that's an easy, pretty easy one to answer.
Yeah, it is easy. The way that we wanted to live on a day-to-day basis was at that point in our life impossible in the U.S. And it was much more possible someplace else. It probably, you know this better than anybody in the whole internet. I can't speak to every county and every place in the whole U.S., mm-hmm. but it was not economically doable. Any place that we were interested in to live, including other countries that weren't Uruguay. And that was the only place for what we knew, like, had to be on the checklist, if you want to put it that way.
And how did we want to live?
Not working a lot, almost at all. I still did work the whole time that we lived there. And well, yeah, except for the first 8 months. Mm-hmm. Only you had a little bit of work. But we still did work. It's not like it was complete non-work, but it was very low hours per week.
Work less while the kids are little.
Correct.
Try to grow a lot of our own food, which in a lot of the U.S. you would have so many regulations to be able to do those things, to build our own house, or to learn how to build, or to like experiment with building structures here in the U.S. Like, yeah, depending on where you're at, you know, you've got a lot of regulations on that, where even in our house, we have building regulations to do like things inside that influence and like impact nobody but us.
Yes. And for how little we kind of gave up in material comfort, it was amazing how much we actually did and on our own. And in the U.S., that is, it's either very illegal or cost prohibitive. But also, what was I going to say? The place you pick to live, where we ended up living, anything that comes in a package, when we moved there, this has now changed in the last couple economic times, last couple of years, but anything that came in a package was always more expensive, which I kind of liked because that stopped us from buying things that were in packages.
Yep.
We've been back for 3 months, and I think we've bought more packaged goods.
Yeah.
In 3 months than maybe in a year and a half.
Yeah. There's a certain thing about like the quality of life where you're kind of forced.
Yes. The physical circumstance and the material circumstance of whatever place it happens to be, it makes you live a certain way. And then it gets you addicted to certain drugs too. So sure.
yeah.
Where's your head at in all this?
Did you say my name? Mm-hmm. Sorry. My head sometimes in the clouds still. yeah, it's very funny because in some ways I do feel like Andy and I are like some of the most American people out there. I mean, like, obviously we interface with a lot of like-minded people because of how much we put ourselves out there, but we have to put ourselves out there quite a bit to do so. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, like, I mean, I've always been good at just, like, finding people around. It's, like, even since we've just been here, like, I've gotten to know more people and all of our neighbors quicker in this last month than probably Andy has.
No, oh, definitely.
He didn't know any neighbors before I came here. Now we know, like, all of our neighbors.
Right.
And I've got all these really cool setups where I'm teaching piano lessons and I'm working for the nearby Amish ladies. And I have, like, probably all of our produce covered for free for the next year or so in a way where we can travel. But I can still work off when we are here for our produce and trade of having produce. Mm-hmm. So like, it just like, I have like a lot of things that I've just like I'm really good at networking and like meeting people and making it work. So that way our costs are like super, super low. Our food costs are basically down to zero now, maybe like $50 a month for milk and eggs. It's about it that we have right now. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like those connections are great, but they only get you so far in a country where all it takes is one person to dislike how you raise your children. And because we're so online, which I think is necessary, I think Andy and I are so values driven that it's very important for us to be public about our values.
Right.
Yeah.
Because we are so much that way where I'm not willing to like put my children at risk, but I also want people to know they can raise their children in a successful way without social security numbers. Like, I think that's an important thing to say because I was raised in a community where nobody ever talked about that. And then when I came of age, it was super difficult for me to know, like, is this actually the best way or not? Like, no one ever told me what to do. I had to figure it out all on my own. And I feel like I can like save other youth that strife if I'm just willing to be public. Yeah. But am I willing to be public at the cost of people ratting on my children, you know, to the CPS? which is not illegal to do. But the thing is, if you're a public person, you can still become a scapegoat, even though something's not illegal.
Right.
And it's just like one of those things. It's like, I want to be American, but maybe I can only be American offshore, you know, kind of thing, which is kind of a sad thought because I love it here. I love the neighbors. I love the people I know. I have so many friends in America. Like, the idea of leaving America is like, it's not terrifying, but it's super, super sad. Yeah. But at the same time, I remember when I was like 14 and 15, like reading all these World War II books, like as a lot of teenagers, you know, get into like a World War II obsession. And I just remember reading all these books and like there was a common theme where like the dad was like, oh, something bad is coming to this country. We must leave. Mm. And the mother would be like, oh, no, I'm not leaving my great grandmother's dishes. And then, of course, the Gestapo comes in and the great grandma's dishes get crushed and the family member gets killed and all these bad things happen. And it's like, well, you could have just left because obviously the dishes got destroyed anyways.
Yeah.
And then now you've also lost half of your children and one of your spouses.
Right. Yeah. Like,
well, I always, at a young age, I was like, okay, I love my dishes. Like, I've had these dishes I've been collecting since I was 9 years old. I love my books. I love my sewing stuff. But those things are going to be taken away from me anyways, no matter how much I cherish them. And I have to, like, put my values in the right place where I'm willing to move and leave things behind if that before something bad happens.
Yeah, I would say, like, World War II movies definitely influenced me, at least. Did they influence you?
Yeah.
In this,
yeah, a little bit. That the piano,
the pianist movie, because like everybody in the neighborhood he lived in was just like,
well, things are okay, it's not that bad, okay,
or they're it's not that bad, and it's kind of like this attitude where people just kind of adapt until it's like their demise, and now it's so extreme that they're literally, you know, in concentration camps. And And at the time, they're just thinking, well, like, this is my home. I'm like, you know, I'm going to stay till the end no matter what. But then, like, is that really adaptive? And so I was thinking about this a lot. But then, yeah. So, I mean, go ahead.
This doesn't sell very well. There is no right answer to this question.
Yeah.
It's too complicated. And there is no one right answer. I don't care. I'm sorry. Whoever says there is a right answer, it's this simple. It is not that simple.
Yeah.
You're doing sound bites. It's not. And it depends.
Yeah. I mean, okay. So
I
met this guy, this man. I don't know if you ever connected with him, Andy. His name's Jared, who lives in upstate New York. And he's like, the first thing he said, and he reminds me of you, about our age, you know, between your age and mine, I think. And he was like, you can't be a peasant in the United States anymore. And I was like, that was like the first thing he said to me. And I was like, yes, I totally get that. He's like, basically I was raised like a peasant up in the woods in upstate New York. And now there seems to be this encroaching thing where like, you can't do it anymore. And then the other thing that we've been facing recently and just been shocked by is like, this rising tide of affluence and the coddled nature of kids, and then like the, you know, obviously like a lot of the woke stuff, you can do your best and try to find your tribe, but then like there's also a point at which you're like, these are all my kids' peers and all of them are on screens all the time, like
every
person they're around is just like, their parents are so permissive with this stuff, like it's obviously the peer influence seeps in. So then you're so worried about that. And that was one of the main reasons also we went to Uruguay, was like American schooling, just at the time, the big issue was Adderall, like making kids sit still. And then just, if they didn't sit still, just prescribing them Adderall. And then they've got all these kids pharmaceuticals and you're just like, I just want to reduce harm. Like, I don't want to expose my kids to this extreme harm. That's on the doomer side, but on the, I would say our experience in Uruguay was quite, wonderful. I mean, like the schooling was relatively, people were normal. There were lots of people who were like more or less mixed peasants still, like doing peasant stuff, but peasant agriculture and then other jobs, which is what most people in the world who do subsistence agriculture do. And, and the kids were really normal and everybody played outside all the time. And there was like, the school was like basically like, every year in school there was some sort of like nature-based activity. Like last year they made paper from scratch, and in the paper they put seeds.
Yeah.
So that when the paper dried, you could like take the paper, and once you were done using it, you could put it in the garden and sprout some plants. I was like, I love everything about this. This is like the most wonderful thing. But then we did reach a point, and I've talked about this before, where I was like, this isn't our home. And these aren't really our people. Like, this isn't our heritage, really. And there's like a lot of things about the heritage there that I love. But there was starting to just become, as the girls got older and more like aware of values and philosophy, that it's like, oh, fundamentally, for example, in Uruguay, which it's fine, this is their culture, it's like, make sure everybody is sharing equally, completely equal, and make sure you don't like draw too much attention to yourself. And, but my, we're kind of like, you know, Americans in the sense of like, hey, if you've got something to say, you stand up and say it. You know, if you've got something to contribute, you make yourself heard. And like, if you are excited about something, show it, you know, whereas in Uruguay, it's like, everybody be quiet and make sure you're listening to the teacher, and everybody gets like an equal amount of speaking time in school. And there was this cultural mismatch starting to show up with our oldest, who's like very outgoing and very curious and like excited to speak, excited to be heard. And like just little things like that, where I was just like, you know, we value this, you know? Go ahead. We're hogging the mic. So what?
Well, I was going to go back to what I said before. And okay. Our day-to-day with when our kids were little in the past 7 years, it was, it's not fair to compare it against present and going forward, because you don't know, you can't predict the future. And I'm like resolved it'll be very nice here also. So I'm going to make it that way,
yeah,
one way or another, even if it kills me. But it was better than what we were doing before. But we only had one daughter at that point. But it was better. The day-to-day was no doubt better. There was a transition time. It was better in that regard, kind of almost beyond debate, don't you think? It was like our day-to-day.
Yeah,
it was. They don't stay little, obviously. And certain things, like the efforts that we had to make to have things be the way that we wanted them to be there, which overall was better, it was kind of draining on us because we're very alone. We did not have aunts and uncles and grandparents who are, most of them still around, only a couple are further away at this point. Some are very close. So that was a big deal. We had a lot of visits, but the people who would come visiting, it's clearly taxing on them. They're getting old and it was hard. And so to maintain those good relationships was also challenging. So like the longer we stay there, the more that the efforts that we were making, were more draining on us and didn't yield as much benefit, which was frustrating, but it was what it was. So
yeah, right.
So these are just things to know in case you
think about
it. Doing this. I don't, I'll be honest, Andy, at least Andy, Keturah, I don't know, but you're one now. So, or soon to be, I think the more nomadic thing or seasonal nomad thing, if I had to do it over again, that could be pretty nice, especially if you're gonna homeschool almost for sure, regardless of where you live.
Definitely.
But this is just my guess. It's nobody can predict the future. I know I've said that three times now, but that's gonna be more up your alley, I think. The seasonal nomad thing.
I really think so. I think that when we say establishing roots, we mean a place to keep the stuff at, and that we will be there occasionally.
Right.
But yeah, you might have something to say, but I this is just something that brings up a curious thing for me, because I've known a lot of families who will go to another country and then, you know, establish their family there, have their children there, and then maybe like 8-10 years into the future, come back to the States kind of thing, and then reestablish themselves in the States. I'm just curious, like, if you guys like know people like that too, because like, I mean, I've seen that this could be a possibility for us too. Like maybe once we were like, we just feel secure that, you know, our children are being raised the way we want them to be raised, and maybe we don't need to have them out of the country as much anymore.
Yeah,
but, I mean, that reintegration process I've seen before can be a really hard process. And I've seen most of the times I've seen, like, the older children go woke. I know, like, a couple families in particular where, like, the older children just, like, really went off the deep end.
Right.
When they reintegrated into society. Right. And that's just something I'm a little worried about, too. Like, being here, I'm worried about that, of course, because, like, all their peers are crazy. Like, even these – I even know some, like, local conservative families where, like, the older children just hate how their parents are raising them. And I don't understand. It's like my friends and I, who were raised very different, we weren't like, oh yeah, when our mom isn't looking, we just take off our dresses in the field and we wear pants, and she doesn't know what books and what movies we watch when we go over to other people's houses. Like, those types of thoughts didn't even cross my head as a 14, 15 year old. But now I'm like interfacing with other 14 and 15 year olds, and I'm like, wow, like a lot of kids really are rebellious for who knows what reason. And they literally just don't appreciate the values that their family are giving to them. And if you have peers like that, who are not appreciating the values from their parents, it could be really hard, because, like, I have a very particular way that I have thought out for how I want to teach my children about a lot of different things, especially when it comes to media and books and films and just education in general. And I don't want to shelter my kids, but I also don't want them to feel like, you know, they have to go somewhere else to do certain things, or that they have to hide, you know, in order to have, like, you know, device time or whatever. Which I don't want to do devices at all, but I also, like, I have, like, these levels where I'm thinking about, like, there's certain things that you have at home, and then there's certain things that you have at the library, and then there are certain things that are, like, okay at the grandparents' place, but there's just also certain things that, at an individual level, maybe, like, you don't want to contaminate yourself with, you know, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that, I just don't know, like, how difficult that really is, like, and that might be even more difficult coming from another country, coming back to the States, you know?
This is, like, such a fundamental question, though. Like, this is not just about, like, going to the U.S. or living in the U.S. or going to abroad. This is basically the fundamental question of how to raise kids right now. And, because it's, like, it is, like, what do you want to instill in them? And how do you keep things you philosophically are fundamentally against away from them? And it can't be completely sheltering them either, because then as soon as they get exposure to something, they have no idea how to integrate it or what to do with it. And then they, like, go off the deep end, or they think, like, you've been keeping this from me, or they, like, want to rebel and expose themselves to it and say, like, maybe this is super interesting and my parents are just totally whacked. And, like, so there's got to be this back and forth, is my opinion, especially as they get older. However, I have a strong opinion that when they're super young, you should super shelter them, like, ridiculously shelter them. And then there's a middle age, and of course our oldest is 10, so we'll see how it turns out. But
whatever you pick as the method, like, it's going to be a big effort either way.
Huge effort, and that's what parenting is in this day and age.
Like, wherever you are living, wherever you whatever you are doing day to day, like, it's a huge effort regardless. Some circumstances that you put yourself into, it's going to make certain efforts even harder, and it's an impossible calculus to know, like, what's worthwhile.
Yeah,
and that's what you that's the challenge of being a human every single day of your life. So either way, it's going to be a big effort. You know that. You've already dealt with that.
But I'm
so,
well,
it's going to go away because it will not.
I don't get the picture that leaving the country is a solution for that sort of thing. I mean, there's nomadic pastoralists on the Iranian steppe whose children are on TikTok, right? Like, this is not a joke. Like, there's nowhere to hide from it. You know,
and
don't think I've researched it. I haven't researched it too, because I've looked into all the different places that have low rates of smartphone ownership, or that have geographical challenges or logistical challenges to bringing cellular service. There's almost nowhere that they can't connect at this point in time, except for a handful of totally forgotten backwaters that have a whole bunch of other problems. You know, like, I think of Isla de Cedros off the coast of Baja California, right? They don't have cell service there, but they also don't have a doctor. You know, like, they don't have basic things, you know?
Yeah.
So am I willing to go that far? I don't know that I am, you know? So at the end of the day, that's just a parenting discussion that isn't really germane to expatriation, I don't think. Just that's my sense anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I'd actually be curious to hear Keturah talk about this, because I would say let's just broadly say I was raised more or less mainstream in the 80s and 90s in Chicago, more or less exposure to movies, video games, but I never got into them much, more like Sonic and Mario Brothers
Yeah,
and
mainstream video games.
mainstream, and then like just whatever processed
Tetris.
cereal and all this stuff. And so I never really felt the need to be like, oh my gosh, there's something out there that I'm like not getting exposed to. But then my parents throughout my childhood, I think, would like push back against more extreme, whatever, gluttony or immoral behavior. And my mom would say stuff. I'd be like, can I do X, Y, or Z thing with my friends? And my mom would be like, no, like we're better than them. Like you're not gonna do that. We're just morally better, so we're just gonna do it this way. And I don't know. At the time, I was like, oh, that's kind of snobby. But I'm just thinking like, no, that's actually what you should say to your kids. Like you should take pride in this. Like you're doing something better, and you're gonna be a better person for it. But I'd be curious, Keturah. So I never like rebelled in that sense because I was like always aware of what these other kids were up to, and it got exposure to a lot. Like I had cousins who had no expo her par their parents wouldn't let them have any sugary cereal at all. And then when they would come to my house, they would like run into the pantry and like eat it really fast. And I was just like, ugh, like why are you doing that? Like because they had no exposure. So then they were like, oh, I get it right now. So I'm gonna like gorge on it, whatever. So I think that's just like a microcosm of that phenomenon. But I'm curious, Keturah, like what do you think went well in your family that made your siblings not rebel from your sort of different upbringing?
Of course, you got to remember in a large family, there's many different segments of families, These older kids, we weren't exposed to that, but my family has changed a lot over the years, and my younger siblings are like heavily exposed to all of that. And
Definitely.
you can see a very like stark difference between the older kids and the younger kids. Like I didn't use a computer until I was like 19 years old. And I don't when I first started using the computer, it didn't consume me or anything. I literally would just use it in the morning to do some writing. And then I had an office job where I would work on the computer, but I hated it so much it just like hurt my eyes and everything. Now I'm at the point where I'm like, oh, I probably couldn't even like I use devices too much, and I'm trying to like figure out how to cut it back because I don't want my children seeing me, in this way, because it just feels like a horrible way for a child to see their parent, But my little siblings, on the other hand, are very techie. They know how to do all sorts of stuff that I wouldn't even dream of knowing how to do with a phone or a computer. They're definitely consumed by it, and it's definitely unhealthy. And that's part of why I'm so staunchly against it, because of how I've seen it consume my little siblings in a very, I mean, they would defend it, obviously, but I just like this, they're very different people as older siblings and the little siblings. And just even the way we have work values. Like I remember when my siblings and I were yet little, we also weren't allowed to have a lot of sugary treats. But if like we happened to have one candy bar given to us, my siblings and I, we would take that candy bar and we would cut it into five even parts so each of us could have a bite of it. And we would, and if someone gave just one of us, like if someone had just given me a candy bar and the rest of my siblings didn't know about it, I wouldn't even think of eating it by myself. I would have taken it to my siblings, like, look what was given to us. And I would share it among all of us kids. My little siblings are the same way. Like they have like open access to all these different things, and they do gorge themselves in those ways. So I want to raise my kids in a way where they appreciate things and they appreciate each other and they think outside of themselves, where like I do want to have limited access to like sugary stuff in general, and maybe like only allow them to have it in the holidays or certain times. And when they do have it in a communal way where it's like this is a fun thing we all get to do together, and not something that's just like for one person to like basically like ha create this spirit of feasting instead of gluttony, And like when it comes to like devices and stuff, like I obviously they need to have some introduction to it, where like I think the library is a great place to that. Like I would have like mo I wouldn't necessarily forbid most fan fiction. Or most, I'm just thinking about this a lot too, because I've been having all these students come who are young girls, and I've just been like observing these, like the spirit in these different girls, and be like, wow, I really like how that girl has been being raised by her parents. I can tell that she's somewhat sheltered, but she's not at all bitter. And then I'm like, what is your parents doing? And like then this other girl who also has been somewhat sheltered, but maybe not completely sheltered, is like singing all these like lyrics to these songs I don't even know that don't sound very good and stuff. I'm just wow, like what did the parents do differently here? And I think it obviously is a spirit from the mother that's coming into the children, or from the parents that's coming into the children, or there's a spirit of disruptness in the family home that's expressing it in whether the child is happy or not, kind of thing. I think that's a core difference, not what, so much being sheltered or what they are allowed to do or not allowed to do. I think it's mostly like how it's being presented to the child.
Yeah.
And what it seems like. And I think that if Andy and I can like continue to like each other as much as we do now, and like present that to a to children, and like that is their roots and that's their security, I think that will also help them a lot in being able to appreciate, like, yes, we do these things because these things are good things, and we don't do these things most of the time because they are bad for us and they will make us not as good of people. And then if we go to the library and it's like, oh, you really want to read the Harry Potter series? Okay, well, let's see if you can handle it without wanting to hang posters all over your bedroom, kind of thing, you know? Like,
Andy, do you have anything to add at the moment? I can go in a different direction.
Well, I think just as a corollary to that, I mean, I grew up totally, totally different from Keturah in that I was an only child. And a lot of what did me good was exposure to the wilderness. And that's what I think, like, you know, you were saying, Pat, about how you could probably see us living a nomadic lifestyle, whether we're living in a bus or we're living in a canal boat or whatever we have figured out. These are ways of life where you're not in a drywall box, hardly ever, maybe literally never. And you're not, there's never a time where you can't hear the birds and you can't see the rain and you can't taste the air. And there aren't, there's just constant opportunities in that way of life for a kid to be outdoors. And to me, I think that, yes, it's important to teach a kid about God. I think that's important because it's eternal and it goes beyond the ephemeralities of everyday modern life. But I think that God is like almost a second order concept in the rational mind of a young human being, whereas wilderness is more intuitively beyond the ephemeralities of everyday life. We're at a very young age, a child can go on a river and see that the river is good and see that the river is not going to hurt him and see that the river has a spirit that nourishes him in some way. And I think if that's the backbone of a kid's psyche, as it was my own, you're armed with a tool that counters the logic of the machine world that we live in. Mm-hmm. And so I think imparting that upon our kids is like paramount to me. I think if I succeed in nothing else but that one thing, we could call our parenting ultimately a success, you know?
Well, that was really well said. And I don't like to do this all the time, once in a while as a treat, like have meta-level conversations about, I'm mostly listening to you guys and not chiming in too much. But this conversation started out as about like leaving the U.S. type stuff.
Yeah, leave the U.S.
And what has it morphed into? It's just, how do you want to have your day-to-day life be? How do you want your family to be? What is important to you? Which is so much more fundamental than just the happenstance of where you are. Because wherever you are, like that's where you're going to be with your family. And it's interesting to watch the conversation morph in that direction. It always kind of turns in that direction, it seems. But they're hard questions, and there is not one answer to them. All the right answers have something in common, obviously. And you've all touched on it, which is you've got to live according to your own morals, and you have to follow your heart, and you have to do what is right. And there's not going to be one answer to it, but you already know this, and you're going in the right direction regardless. Go ahead.
You have to be in the world and not of the world is another thing.
Yeah,
you
but
know.
What I was going to say, the last thing was, we mentioned it before, you have got to set yourself up, like materially and in the like the physical circumstance that makes it the most easy for you to carry out the idealized version of what you want your life to be, which is you're never going to get. Nobody ever will. I don't know. Get to 88% of it. Get to 91% of it.
Yeah. Well, okay. So I would add a couple of things. One is there's an argument people say, like, Well, so there's two arguments to be made here. You on the one hand, you can say like, well, wherever you go, there you are. Like, it doesn't matter where you are, but like fundamentally you have, you're bringing yourself there and you're bringing your philosophy and like, you need to make it work no matter where you are. But then the counter argument to that is like, yeah, I mean, but there's a limit to that. Like if you get into an extremely toxic or traumatic social situation, it's not just like your mindset. It's like you're literally in a bad social situation that's going to harm you and your children. And so you need to get out of that. I'm not convinced that the US is that latter thing yet, but it can be if you are yourself or your kids, unthinking in it and not using your agency in it. And so I think, so my whole thing about moving to Uruguay is like, I'd rather, you know, people can say, oh, you can be a lotus in a cesspool. You can still be a lotus no matter like if you're in a cesspool. But I'm like, one of our favorite authors said like, I mean, you could be a lotus in a cesspool or you could just be a dirty lotus. Like the dirt gets on you, you know? And right. So in Uruguay, like for example, things were quite beautiful. I mean, we weren't in a cesspool. We were in a wonderful rural community of people who are like very kind and very, you know, spent a lot of time outdoors and, you know, just swimming in this whole social situation that was just very human, you know, and a lot more free. A lot of things we could do on our rural property was like, nobody's coming to check.
There's nobody. There's no sheriff. There's nobody there to enforce it. If they were there, they would be too lazy to enforce it. So that is nice.
Yeah.
And
that's what we want.
Yeah. Well, because.
Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
I think that's the central thing is like when you're talking about the sheriff and you're talking about the state, because I'm used to having scorn heaped upon me. I've nearly done that professionally for my whole life, and it doesn't faze me at all. And I'm convinced, too, that I could arm our children to be tolerant of that just the same as I am and just the same as Keturah is. But when the government wants to come for you in this country, you know, I hate to be fixated on some of these cases that some may say are extreme. But, you know, when I met Keturah, her and her father both gave me copies of this book called The Federal Siege at Ruby Ridge, right? And I had known about Ruby Ridge, but knowing the fullness of the story, how Randy Weaver was set up by the ATF to conduct an illegal transaction almost unknowingly, and was framed by the media in a certain way so that the ATF could surround his house and shoot his son in the back and murder his wife who was holding his baby. Yeah. From a helicopter, right? This is an extreme case, but nonetheless, there is a non-zero chance that it could occur to anybody in the U.S. who lives here. And that non-zero chance is increased by being a dissident, by publicly being a dissident, by not living in a drywall box, by not working for a wage, and by not paying your taxes, and by not having a social security number. And like, all these things add up to where if they want to paint you to look like a domestic terrorist and then shoot you or separate your kids or weaponize CPS against you or bring codes enforcement in to bulldoze your house, they'll do it and they'll get away with it. And people will laugh at your plight and the traumatic reality of just trying to be a free person in the land of the free, right? That's the thing that it comes down to for me is, I can handle how miserable most Americans are and a bunch of tattletale, peeping in the window, calling you in, reporting like you live in a big HOA. I can handle that, whatever. I mean, it sucks, but I can live with it. But when the government comes for you, you are powerless, because if you fight back, then, I mean, if you do a little of that, you're going to wind up in a jail cell and you'll never see your family again. And that's the way that they play in this country. And it makes me sick. You know?
Yeah, it's like this. The who had this term inverse totalitarianism, like We're just, who was it? Do you remember?
Oh no, but it's old. It's like,
but we're basically,
it's where, yeah,
like,
you don't even need,
we don't even need the state. Like there's, we're being authoritarians to ourselves. Like I posted about like these kids being coddled with water bottles, and I got a thousand quote tweets and like a dozen evil.
What, 1,000?
Yes. And a bunch of evil DMs where people are like, I hope your kids get taken away from you. I hope that you're such a terrible mother. You're abusive, blah, blah, blah. And it's like that. I mean, that's a real class and a real thing to be worried about is like, if you also, what you guys are saying, like you are publicly standing up for being more free, for like this original American ethos. And then this, like, you know, reverse totalitarian class will completely come after you. And that is a legit
thing. It's like, well, you're kind of going to get, you're going to get that.
Between
you're okay with the negative attention. Yeah. You're not okay with just like the life ruining on a whim.
Right.
But it's
not. Boom, that's it. And as a corollary to that, right? Like, take the example of Greenlee County, Arizona. It's a county with very low property taxes and no building codes. It's actually codified in county law. We don't have building codes and we never will, right? We could buy land there, drill a well, build a place, live out there with no social security numbers, homeschooling, and nobody would care. But the problem is that if you want to speak publicly about it, then all of a sudden you might attract this attention, right?
Yeah.
But so people will say, they'll say, oh, we'll just keep quiet. And it's like, well, that's not freedom. That's
right.
Not that if you got to hide to be free, you're not free.
And
right?
Not to mention like
the
drift. There's so much cultural drift. If you just, everyone who's doing something, which they perceive to be the original American ethos, but others perceive to be abusive or traumatic or wrong or whatever, they will, like, the drift is real. And if you don't speak out about it and anybody who does that is quiet about it, then it just becomes this thing where, like, anyone who's living according to their values is forced to be quiet. Then, like, you know, it just, there's this cultural drift. Were you going to say something?
And the funny thing is you can get along with most of your community. Like, we like most of the people around us. I can't really think of anyone that we know that we don't like around us. But that's not the problem when you're a rider or a traveler. You interface with so many more people than just your own community.
Right.
And even so, there could be just one person in your community who secretly doesn't like you, or one person online, you know, who just like has it out to make your message impossible, you know, kind of thing.
Right. And well, I don't know. Maybe your best defense, because you're right, everything you say is true. It's beyond debate that it's true. That it, is it going to happen or not? I don't know. Maybe your best defense is just keep being really eloquent about the way you talk about it. Don't do anything actually illegal, as in like the violence and rebellion, or what was it called? What was the thing called at the Capitol?
Insurrection.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know if that's the best defense. You might just be ending up in a history book either way. You know, cast as the bad guy, or then cast as a bad guy, and then the revisionist historians come around and like, nah, he was right. You'll be just like the Ned Ludd of the early 21st century. I don't know. I can't tell you what is right. I appreciate you though, and I like that you say all these things. Almost like I love your posts about like you could do this thing, and how triggering it is for people. And I'm just watching this like, oh yeah, I could do that. I'm not gonna be
right. And I know that. I know you're not gonna. Most people aren't.
But the funny thing is, I have done some of the things, and that's how I know that it is totally doable. And it's
thinking about what I have the power to do, because look, like people can do things.
And I can't get I get such a kick out of how what an existential strain it puts on the people who react so badly. It's like, look, there are 1 billion things that you can do that you're not going to do. Why are you so threatened by one guy with a giant beard who hasn't shaven since October, it looks like? And why are you so threatened by just that he exists? Like, what's the problem? Why and why
well,
do you
know,
want to be
you know why I do it?
Things are possible. I just
I do it because there's so many people that are having an aneurysm about the cost of housing, the cost of things, and they're freaking out. And they and literally the way it's structured, whether you're a leftist or a fascist or far right or a Republican or whatever you are, right, is there's a problem. I want it my way. If I don't get my way, I'm going to be mad, and I need a political solution. I need a savior, right? This is un-American to think this way. This is like some kind of almost communist way to think, right? And so if you tell those people, hey, the thing that you want, you can go out and get it for yourself right here and now and save yourself a heart attack, maybe it helps somebody. I don't know.
The thing you just said was one of the things that I was constantly thinking about 7-8 years ago when we moved in the first place was the only like freedom that you're encouraged to exercise in the US is like do a startup, try to make as much money, like that's within this system.
Yeah.
And it's just really nauseating because you've seen what that does and you see what it does to the individuals who pursue it. You see how they treat other people, and you can talk about, I don't understand the, I don't want to get too vulgar, but this, all the apologies and the apologists for just like, oh, he's just like, it's just business. He's just cutthroat, and he gets what, like, you can pursue things you want in more than just this one direction. And it is a kind of a one-dimensional thing that is, broadly speaking, that's like encouraged and admired in American culture that I'll admire parts of it. And I understand the appreciation for the certain traits of the people who are, you know, just like the Rockefellers and that type of thing. And whatever the list of famous rich guys who we know their names because they built all the stuff, and I'm glad some of the stuff was built, but just like the deity status they have, and how like the only freedom that you're encouraged to exercise is like go become a bazillionaire. There's other things worth pursuing, and if you don't think that, you're wrong. It's kind of not much more complicated than that.
Okay, but one thing I did want to get on the record in this conversation is both of your guys' like ability to see points of agency can also be used in the context of like this reverse authoritarianism, reverse totalitarianism. You can still find, and this is basically where we're at the moment, you still can find so many points of agency to put your attention and focus on things you want to see more of, and speak publicly against things you don't want to see happening. And like one example that's happening for us right now, maybe 7 years ago or 8 years ago, I would have been like, oh my gosh, this is horrible. We need to just like get our kids out of school entirely. And now I'm starting to feel more and more like, my daughter's like first social studies assignment when she came home was define anti-racism. And I'm like, okay, here we go. Okay. So woo. I sit down with her and I'm like, look, I'm a sociologist. Like I'm steeped in all this liberal stuff. Like I actually think systemic racism is a real thing, but then it's turned into this completely wild, you know, wild west of like blame. It's like the psychology of it is so weird. So I'm sitting down with her and I'm like, yeah, so like basically a lot of these things happened in the past. Some of them are, the effects of them are still ongoing, but that does not mean, so, you know, whatever, I'm going into the detail with her about it. And I think there is maybe, you know, 8 years ago when we were less confident in the kids we've raised from little infancy, like in toddlerhood, I would have been like, oh my gosh, protect them at all costs, get them away from this stuff. But now I'm increasingly of the point of the feeling of use your agency, man, fight back, let them be exposed to it, and not some of the extreme stuff, of course, like keep them as far away from some of the exposure to some of the worst stuff, obviously, as possible. But some exposure to it and the ability to inoculate your kids against it is also a point of agency. Speaking out against it is a point of agency. I like, as soon as I came across the kids' sex ed curriculum and it's totally out of control bad, and I'm writing an article about it. As soon as I got exposed to it, I'm like, I'm writing an article about it. I'm going to speak up about this. There's over 300,000 kids in Chicago public schools. And you have all these parents who are not paying attention. And every parent I've talked to about it is like, wait, they're teaching what? And they're shocked.
Including a couple of CPS teachers.
Teachers who, but
they changed it from last year to this year, and like just and they're a lot of Trojan horse stuff. Like they're putting actual true information in there, and then just sneaking in
and so
just made up stuff.
Like this is my community. I'm not letting it get taken over by these radicals. And most people I talk to agree with me. They just need somebody to like speak up and not be afraid. And so I'm
right.
Of that attitude of using my agency for this.
Sure.
I like a couple things what you said in that, like for sure, like that I think can be applicable to ourselves. Even just how you said earlier about sheltering them when they're really little. I think that is very essential. If you shelter children when they're really little, like I'm very opposed to having 10, 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old sheltered kids who don't know how to like deal socially with the world outside of their home. Like that I'm opposed to. But it does make sense to shelter kids, you know, like at least at 2 or 3 years old. I want independent kids by the time they're 5 for sure.
Yeah.
But like it makes sense to have, you know, secure babies that can then go out and then be like this, like, you know, 10-year-old activists in their community. Like, right. I love that vision. And you do feel less, more safe that way because CPS, when they come and question kids by the time they're 10 and 12, those kids have enough say whether or not, you know, they get taken away. Yeah. I mean, not complete say, but they have more say in that. Whereas if they come and try to attack you when you have like little toddlers, that you have less control over how that plays out.
Yep.
And so maybe it does make sense for us to just kind of like, you know, travel a lot when our kids are really, really little and then make our firm stand when they're a little bit older.
Well, that's actually, that actually is a good point too, because
let me
kind of work backwards here and just tell you guys what I'm thinking, because like the nuclear option for us that I can see is probably the southern three provinces of Argentina, where there's just a historical tradition of immigration, right? There's immigrants from all over, Boers who were kicked out of South Africa, Welsh who were starving to death. They show up in Chubut or in Santa Cruz or in Patagonia, whatever, and they live there. And this is normal and accepted, right? So that's the nuclear option. It's on the other side of the planet.
Yeah.
You know, it would be hardcore.
You're right. Fine.
The more still expatriating but a little closer to home option is Mexico, right? Like I used to live on the border and I understand a lot about Mexican culture and the way that they value like the campesinos, like the peasant culture of that place is so beautiful. But here is an interesting thing, because living in the American Southwest, one, you're in the desert, there's just fewer people. Two, the people who live there are tougher and more tolerant of weird, unorthodox ways. And three, if the shit hits the fan, you can get into Mexico in, you know, a couple hours, right?
And I have friends there who have political asylum from the States.
Here's the thing.
Yeah.
Is going the other way and saying, okay, well, we live in the American Southwest, which I love the place. I know she would like it. I love upstate New York, but maybe there is an argument for going back to the desert. I learned in the military that if you know the policies you're up against better than your enemies, then you can cite those policies. And if you can point to hard-coded laws and policies and say, yep, what I'm doing is legal and correct, and I know more about it than you do, then you can embarrass these officials, and they need to be embarrassed. They deserve to be embarrassed and, you know, brought to their knees. So there's a continuum of different options. Holy. And I don't really want to go to Tierra del Fuego just to be an American if I can help it.
Yes.
But the Southwest seems to be the sort of place that would be more amenable to us if we are to stay in the States. Also, because there's a ton of federal land, so we could be nomadic on the federal land and it would be technically legal, you know?
Yeah, well, I think one thing that I would just say that I think a lot of people don't think this way, but I got exposed to it early on in our lives that it helped me a lot, is like your life doesn't also have to just be one thing. Like you don't have to just pick one thing and stick with it for your whole life. Like I met a friend, or I learned about like the FIRE movement, the financial independence, retire early. And I was like looking into all of this stuff around the time of the Great Recession, because a lot of people were talking about like how to live cheaply and how to like maybe get out of the grind and to, you know, maybe all of this stuff where you're like working at the same job for 35 years and then retiring at 65, maybe there's a different approach to life than that. And then I came across a mother who talked about retiring, mini retirements. And I've talked about this before, but like mini retirements or like working less when your kids are super little. And that really like got my gears turning about like there can be seasons of life, like periods of life. And so like maybe when your kids are little, you're, you know, in a trailer in New Mexico and raising them, homeschooling them while they're super little and while you're pregnant, Keturah, and nursing a lot, and you're not having like this huge schedule and this time like grind to like make as much money as possible. Like you make little, but you don't need much. I mean, you've got cloth diapers, you're breastfeeding, like, you know, you don't really need much to get by in that situation. And that can be your home base. And you can travel from there and, you know, bring the little kids around with you. And it's, you know, a really beautiful season of life. And then as they get older, like more structure, less sheltered, you know, more exposure and whatever that looks like as the next step. And then I would just say the third thing that I like absolutely have to say is I think that you should always have the nuclear option of where you have to go in case things get really bad. I just like Uruguay, we still have our property there. If things go crazy or if we, you know, like for example, like have some sort of run in with what X, Y, or Z regulatory issue, not that we're doing anything extreme, but you never really know. And people get tangled up in things that they like, because they're outspoken and because somebody wants to target them for being different, that we're able to get out of here and get there. And we have ties there. We have community there. We know how it works. And, you know, we would be able to live there on the cheap for indefinitely. And so like, you know, anyways, I just think people can be really flexible. I think you can try out different things and see what works with for you guys. I love the idea of like living in the desert while they're little and, you know, being able to the other thing I would just think, like, if you have a bug out location outside the United States, you should have a specific one. Should always have a specific bug out location. Like, you know where to go specifically and have like a tie to that place. So, I mean, it would almost be worthwhile for you guys to explore that, like by going places and like finding a specific place at this
point. It's so true. It's so true. And it would not be hard in our case to buy a little ranchito in Coahuila or something in some of the safer parts of Northern Mexico.
Yep.
And to even spend the summers there, spend the winters there or whatever, and sort of be there on a seasonal basis. And honestly, what you're saying too, because it's interesting, like the further south you go, I mean, obviously like Latin America is complicated, South America is complicated, but like this idea of like the furthest southern tip of South America is like, from all I can discern, is like a very free place where they don't really care what you do, right?
Yeah.
And I can almost imagine like a reverse underground railroad, right? When things get really bad in the U.S., there's way stations all the way, you know, and we'll get Doomer Optimist podcast people taking you across the Darien Gap, you know, like.
There's Anabaptist communities in most of those countries, and Anabaptist communities were often, you know, the homes of the underground railroad. So
right.
You really could have, they wouldn't be Quaker, but you could have at least Amish and Mennonite underground
railroad there's stations. And there's also Amish and Mennonite basically all the way from North America down to the tip of Patagonia. They're everywhere.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah, we know that.
If you're thinking about the American frontier mentality, they're the ones living it.
Quakers in Costa Rica.
Yeah,
they have a cheese factory.
Yeah.
They're the most.
Yeah. Oh, I've heard of them. I've heard of them.
Yeah, we've been in their factory.
Where we got
engaged. We stayed at this hotel, and this kid is just, it's just looked, they came from Alabama in like 1952, 53 or something. Yeah.
It's like
this kid's blonder than anybody. He's saying like Costa Ricans already have like a little bit of an R that sounds more English R, ruh, Costa Rica. And and this is just like, how is this a native Spanish speaker? And he's just
speak Spanish like he sounded.
So okay, the R is at the tip of the tongue most of Latin America and Spain. Costa Rica for most places, but they say Costa Rica. It's like in the back of your mouth, like the like the R is, and that's just for any Costa Rican. Like? Este señor hablaba así como norteamericano, pero And he's a native, but he sounds like
really?
Spanish.
So they live there.
Spanish
two
students.
They only probably speak English between them.
Because this kid was probably born in 1980, so they've been there like 30 years from now. So it maybe speaks English too, but it's just they got a nice cheese factory. It's on the top of a mountain, the most terrifying bus ride you've ever taken. Ashley almost died of a heart attack. And I think you were more scared than me.
I was smoking a cigarette.
Wait, on a cell phone.
And so I was like, you don't have enough hands
on an unpaved road.
Yeah. And the
with
cliff
50
like,
foot cliffs, 60, 100 foot cliffs, absolute guaranteed death if you fall.
It's kind of, there's a bunch in Brazil and in Argentina, I'm assuming there are some. I don't know of them in particular. Yeah, so I just personally think, like, there is also, like, an American heritage of being a pioneer and, you know, and going to foreign lands and, you know.
There's some crazy gringo in every, like, there's thousands in some of the countries, but, like, every county, every state you go to in Latin America, there's always a couple crazy gringos, and they're usually pretty well received overall, as long as they're not, like, too shonky. They can't just be trying to take over everything. And they can't just be like club mad.
You know what's a funny corollary to this too of this kind of things get bad in America and the sort of frontier real Americans go south is, you know, you see people on the right wing going nuts about like the Latinization of the United States and how you know there's this demographical creep north. It's almost I almost wonder if you play these things out to the fullest, where there's 1 million Americans, more than 1 million Americans living in Mexico alone, and many of them are what they call mojados, which are illegal immigrants to Mexico from America, right? You could almost see a reversal of the polarity, right? Where all of the Latinos that want to have Nikes and like nice lawns and big SUVs, they come up here, and all of the Americans that are like, I just want to like, rattle my rusty truck down through the tropics in the forest, right? They're going to go down there. So the net result could actually be very beautiful. You know, it's just because they can Latinize the United States doesn't mean we can't sort of Americanize parts
in
of Latin America
sense.
In a good way.
Yeah. Oh my God. I love that vision so much. Now, the only other thing I want. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Katora. I was going to change the subject.
I was just going to say, I love how you say different, like, you know, your life doesn't have to be like one thing. I think a lot of Andy's Twitter followers like miss out on this because Andy's always like one day he's like, oh, I'm going to live in a canal boat. And the next day he's like, I'm going to like take my kids across the States in a bus. And another day he's like, what about this crazy idea? And then another day he's like, what about this crazy idea? What people don't get is that Andy and I, while we're not going to be able to do all of it, I bet we're going to do a lot of those different things. Because like we love having fun and we don't like being tied to one specific thing or one specific
Life's too short.
Life is short and long. But I was just gonna say you have so much time in your life to try different things. And I do think like people get stuck in a routine and they just like don't explore enough. I mean, now that we're here and like every time we had free time in Uruguay, we would be going to explore places. We went to this place, Punta del Diablo. It was like gorgeous, amazing sand dunes and rocks. And we're going and exploring with the kids along the beach. And now that we're here, I'm like, I can't wait to get back into the American West and get out there with the kids. Like, this is the golden age of childhood. They're 10, 7, and 4 this summer. And it's just going to be like, oh, we can, you know, explore. It's going to be magic for them and magic for us to show them. It's going to be so amazing. So, yeah, I think there's just so many things you can explore in life and why not? And I think like a lot of people, they do like a lot of these people, they get resentful for you suggesting that they should use their agency.
Well, they find it confusing because they expect you to make your identity about one thing.
Same with me.
I think humans are too complex for that. And like, I think that we're a bit too complex for that. Like we aren't going to make our identity out of a couple like things that you can do in life. We're going to do too much for that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and people got confused with me too, because I am simultaneously both a fan of people who do homeschooling well, and also now a fan of, you know, not ceding the public schools to things that I don't agree with. And so people are like, I don't know what to make of you. And I'm just like, you know, it can be multiple things at once, context dependent. And like, if you're doing homeschooling well, like good for you, go for it. But Also, like, I'm kind of the attitude of like, I had a public school education and it was super formative for me in a good way. Like, I loved being around different kids who I wouldn't have been exposed to if I had gone to a private school or were homeschooled.
And we survived first wave multiculturalism
Yeah,
in the
right.
90s.
The
And
90s
I'll put this
multiculturalism
in the
and
notes because the acronym CPS has been used in two different ways today. It's
Chicago Public
the
Schools.
Chicago Public Schools, the one time I did it. We'll put it in the notes. Don't worry. We'll make sure we
Oh, funny. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we like learned the Black National Anthem and stuff in
Still
school,
know
which
it.
I think is a beautiful song. And it was like,
Good
okay, so we
melody.
know these things. And yeah,
It's
I'm.
a kind of a good, it's like almost a better song than the real one, but a little divisive.
Okay, but then the other thing I wanted to bring up was the other thing that is just irreplaceable and something we need to talk about while you're making this decision is family ties and friend ties. And like, I do think, barring extreme unrest, keeping up those ties is so important. And like, Couture, you have a giant family, and like basically when we moved away to Uruguay, we came back every year. We continued to stay connected to family and friends. But now that my siblings and his siblings increasingly are having kids, like my kids now have this like more active relationship with their cousins, which I just find really, really important. Like being able to be there for our parents as they get older, that's really important. And there's also like a duty, loyalty, and tied up in that. And it doesn't mean you can't like go and travel or spend time doing different things for seasons, but like fundamentally being a reliable family member who's like who's around, it's just being around and having these moments together. That's just one thing I want to like highlight, because one thing we didn't really realize in Uruguay, because at the time we kind of felt isolated from our families in Chicago even while we were here. When we were there over the course of the 7 years, it was just kind of like, we've got friends, they're reliable, but it's just a different level with family of reliability and like helping one another out. And you just have those kin ties, like the kin relationships, like they just can't, people do like a Friendsgiving. Yeah, you can do a Friendsgiving, that's fine, but it's like this kin relationship is not the same as what anything you can build in like a community. And I think that's one thing we were a little bit hubristic about with Uruguay, was like, we can build our community, and everyone was so kind there and they were reliable, but it's just so different. Like, hey mom, can you come over and sit with the kids? We've got an appointment or something. And it's like just having someone physically around all the time to rely on, like a whole network of people, I would say, is really
Yeah,
important.
Andy, where's the Amtrak go? Is there an Amtrak that goes from Montana down to the Southwest? I'm sure
There
there is.
is.
We took it, Emily.
Yeah. Yeah, it exists. It
Oh, we're
exists.
taking that.
Yeah,
You can
it's
take the train
tough.
from out here. You can take the train to Glacier National Park. You don't even have to take a
Yeah, we
car.
just took that. We just took that in the fall. Yeah, we went just from east of Glacier National Park to upstate New York. It took about 45 hours or something like that. It was a
About
ride, you know.
24
It
from
was
here
beautiful. We
to
go over the
that's
Mississippi River. There's bald eagles when the sun's rising, and I don't know. It's like heaven to me. But the family discussion is hard for me because my this is the thing, and one of Keturah's friends was recently talking about how if you really value your community, don't make yourself irreplaceable, right? Pass off the reins to somebody
right.
because if you're irreplaceable, or if somebody wants to flatter you and they say, "What would we do without you?" It's like, well, you better know what you'd do without me because I won't live forever and I want this community or this family to keep living. And
Right.
the perfect exemplifying note about that is my own great grandmother. She was the matriarch of my 45 person extended family that all lived in one town. And she held it all together. She was at her house. She called it Grand Central Station. Everybody was over every day. And those were the glory days of my youth. It was like living in a Norman Rockwell painting. And then she died. And everybody fought over the estate because she grew up in the Great Depression. and she had cash under mattresses and jewels and boxes. And I mean, she was actually worth something, even though she lived poorer than a church mouse.
Yeah.
And these people, her sons and daughters are, I mean, they're practically ripping each other's hair out over it. And now the family has, it's finished. You know, my aunt's a drunk. My uncle's a drunk. My other uncle's a hermit. And my grandma's disillusioned. And all of the younger generation, they're all just on their phones and they don't give a damn about anything.
Yeah.
So I really have my grandmother and uncle who won't live forever. And I have my cousin who's my best friend, but all he does is work to pay for the expense of living a high dollar, normal American lifestyle. So, and I lost all my friends. You know, all my friends were anarchists. So I joined the military and they back off. And then I become Catholic again. They back off. And then Roe v. Wade happens and they say, what do you think of this? I say, I think it's great. And they say, never speak to me again. And so it's like, okay, now all of my friends are people I've met on Twitter. So I could go anywhere because the relationships that I have take place through venues like this call and like being in the group chats and on Twitter and all this stuff. That's my social reality. So I could be in Mongolia and still have friends. You know,
I'll stay your friend, Andy, even though you're a weirdo.
Great.
Petura, what are your thoughts on the family question?
What was that?
What are your thoughts on the family question?
Well, it's kind of like I have mixed thoughts about it, I guess, because like I do have a lot of family in Montana, but I if anything, like I was telling my dad the other day, I was like, what if we just all moved to Mexico? Because their property taxes are so crazy. And growing up, my dad always moved every couple of years. It's kind of odd that we've been in one place now for 8 years.
Right.
So I'm just like, isn't it time we move? Like, it's a struggle every single year to pay the property taxes.
Yeah.
And it's just inevitable that we're not going to be able to pay them some year kind of thing, because they just continue to go up and they're just completely unaffordable. And it's just very crazy. Like we have a very good high lifestyle. We make good money and everything in Montana, but for some reason the property taxes just get us every year.
Yeah.
And I mean, I can't remember if it's 5,000 or 11,000 a year. I always forget the number.
It went up, didn't it? To 11,000 from 5,000.
Is that what
right?
It went up from 5 to 11?
Yeah.
So anyways, and it's like when you have that much of a jump and you're not expecting it to just like suddenly go up, you know, in a year, and you're like, "Oh, well, I put 5,000 away for the property tax. Oh, wait, it's going to be 11,000 this year."
Yeah.
Like that's a considerable jump, you know.
Yeah. Well, maybe you guys could be the ones who pioneer and locate a spot in Mexico, and then the Lamb family follows along.
I kind of envision something like that. Like, I feel like eventually if we put roots somewhere, that we're going to have people that follow us.
Yeah.
And especially just like even if it's like not too far away, like if it's in Argentina or something, it might be slightly harder. But my dad has always talked about leaving the country.
Or Mexico.
My dad has always had dreams to do that.
Yeah.
Some of my siblings may or may not go along with that. Like there may be certain siblings that don't, but already my siblings are starting to scatter. Like one brother is likes a girl in Indiana. Another brother likes a girl in North Carolina. One of my sisters is with a guy in Missouri. So it's just kind of like, you know, we're already starting to scatter, and there we may be able to get some sort of a semblance of people together.
Yeah.
But also, you know, when you have a family that large, there's always so much drama. It's like, it's nice when we see each other, but do we want to see each other all the time? Like, you got to, like, figure out a way how to make that work where it's great. And then my friends are the same way. Like, I have a lot of friends, like, a lot of really good friends. But I met my friends by traveling. So, like, my best friends are in North Carolina and Kentucky. And I have some friends in New York, but they're, like, 5 hours from us here. But I used to visit them a lot back when I was, like, you know, single and able to go all over the place by myself.
Yeah.
But yeah, my friends are the same way, where they're not necessarily rooted to where they're at. And if we created this sort of community where it's like, this is really good, and they're all kind of like me, where they want to raise kids that are, you know, not part of the normal status quo, you know.
Yeah.
If we created a community that was like, oh, this is really cool, this is really good, you can come here and have your own space, and there's not going to be a lot of drama, like in fighting community drama, and there's also not going to be a lot of like authority from like local people, then I kind of envision people following us.
Yeah,
but I don't know.
And I will also just say one thing about that too, is that if it could go the other way. We don't necessarily have to create it. You know, like if somebody has a group or, you know, some kind of node of like-minded folks in a place that is affordable, because a lot of people, there's a lot of cool people, they live in unaffordable places, so I'll never be their neighbor. Simple as. But if somebody is doing something good in an affordable place and they meet us and they love us and they say, why don't you just stay? We really might.
Yeah.
I'm totally open to that just about almost anywhere.
And I'm not interested in going to Montana where my family's at or in the nearby states just because of that reason. Like, it's the cost of living. It's only affordable if you happen to have something that's pre-established. But even then, it's super hard to keep a hold of it because of the property taxes.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, all of that, like, I mean, I guess my takeaway from this conversation is just there's no straightforward right answer. You need to consider all of these things at once. And then, you know, just like experiment and try things out. Use your agency. Whether you're in a situation in the United States like we are, which I think is probably one of the more extreme, you know, in terms of being under the yoke of a modern industrial liberal American city where, you know, the normies are taking over or trying to. And I guess I wouldn't say the normies, because most of what I would say is our neighbors and a lot of the people I think still have what I would consider to be normal values, meaning they're not on board with a lot of this extreme stuff. But it's just taking over so rapidly. And, you know, whether you're on that or if you're, you know, on the extreme other end and just exploring Patagonia to see if it's the place you want to have as your bug out location, and exploring Mexico and, you know, the Southwest and trying different things out, traveling around. I think, I mean, it's really just all an exploration, and all of that is fine. And you just have to consider a lot of these things at once.
By the way, though, just personally, I think you should try to make as much money as you can while you have no kids. I would have done that. I would have just worked a little bit more, because then the more you work when you don't have the kids, you can work even less when you do. I don't know. That's what I think.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you can try.
I mostly did that, but I didn't go all the way.
He had like a regular, regular teaching job before our kids were born, and while the oldest one was little. And even when she was little, like him going away to work for her first year of life and being gone from 6 a.m. to 4 p.m. Like,
yeah, I wouldn't have done much different, but I would have just,
it's just so sad. I personally
worked a tiny bit more.
For me, I'm pretty radical on this point. I just think that it is so sad for parents and dads too to be away from their infants and toddlers. Like, I just think
it's so isolating
to be with their infants completely alone with nobody else around. And even if they do have other people around, like, it's so nice to have the dad there for you know, moral support. They're the ones who have the genetic desire to have this offspring survive well, so they're gonna have the incentive to help the mom like succeed and to breastfeed and to
hold the baby. People stuck around long enough to watch this part. Like, I'm actually advocating working a ton, which is out of
Of that. Before the babies are little, and then after the kids have gotten to an age where, you know, if the mom is homeschooling or the kids go to school, like, they're in more of a routine where then, like, the dad could go away to work while they're in, like, the schooling mode, and it's not that big of a deal. Whereas when they're babies, like, I just feel like, I feel so sad. Obviously, like, moms putting their babies in daycare at, like, 6 weeks, but I even feel sad for when moms are stay-at-home moms and then their husbands get, like, a week or 2 weeks to be home with them, and they just had a baby and they have this tiny infant and the dad's like peacing out at 6 a.m.
Oh, it's horrible. It's horrible.
Yeah. And I would do anything in my power to avoid that.
Yeah, I'm opposed to that for sure.
We're living now on less than $1,000 a month, and I make more than $1,000 a month.
Yeah.
Just writing. And between the two of us, we probably have $20,000 saved. And I have the GI Bill, which, if we play our cards right with it, we could get over $100,000 in cash.
Yeah.
And I've made investments, and I have little things coming in too and stuff.
Yeah. So I would be hustling if I were you guys at this stage. Like, as much as you can save and put away, that's just freedom. You know, that's freedom that to then make choices later on that you can make. You could buy some property, you know, or you can be free to live off of those savings if you're traveling, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah, right. That's good advice for sure. Yeah. I've even been thinking of other ways to put things away, you know, for when we might be poor in the future, such as like if I see good deals in fabric, I like even just for like making clothes for the kids, I go and buy the fabric now because I figure I'll have a harder time affording fabric.
Yeah.
When I have little ones, but at least now I'll have like things to make them stuff out of and stuff.
I love that. Yeah.
The mothball method. What's what we'll call it. Because you got to get mothballs also.
Right.
Wine moths were terrible.
Yeah, they really those got into man.
And I don't even know how to say mothball. Well, yeah, I do.
Do you?
I would be making it up, but I never saw the mothballs at the grocery store. Let's put it that way. Anyway, continue.
Anyways, I think this is good. I think it's good to just kind of like ruminate on these things out loud. Like, I think a lot of people kind of get stuck in X, Y, or Z pattern of what people expect of them, and they kind of just go along with it, and they don't think, I think, intensely or agentically about what is possible for them.
You got it.
And so
too long didn't read. There's not one answer.
But also it's unsatisfying, but it's also an invitation, because it's unsatisfying because there's no like set answer to this. Like, it's not like, you know, a lot of people will be like, oh my gosh, Uruguay, wow, it seems like a dream. Like, no, it's not. There's challenges here as there is everywhere, and you need to figure it out for yourself, and it's not going to be easy. Nothing's going to be easy. Like, and the only real fantasy of like things being easy is like rich Americans going to live in like a condo on the beach in Mexico where they have like, you know, maid service and all of this stuff. But then those people are also fundamentally dissatisfied because they're just like, you can only drink margaritas every day for so many days. And then it becomes like, what am I doing with my life? So it's always a challenge of like, balancing meaning and work and family responsibilities and like, you know, fighting off the yoke of the state and all of this stuff. And so we wish you luck. You guys will be fine because you're asking these questions even. And I think it's also just nice to model these kinds of conversations for people who aren't even feeling empowered to have them.
And there's tons of people want to be Andy and Keturah when they grow up. So keep up the good work because you're doing a good job.
Any final words?
What?
Any final words from you guys?
She's going to kill you with a drone.
I just feel like this has been an encouraging conversation for sure. That just being able to talk to like other people. Sometimes we like run each other dry with our own conversations.
Well, it's hard because you get to a point where you know you need advice, but there's not anybody who you can ask for advice because everybody else's values are nutty and you know it.
Everyone's an idiot.
They don't know enough.
This is just the beginning. Let's keep this conversation going. But my answer is never going to really deviate too much from the fact that there is not one right answer. Sorry, that's my brand. It's not satisfying. Yeah. It doesn't sell well.
Definitely.
But I think it's true.
If your guy's stage before you're even married, save as much money as possible and take this opportunity before you have little kids, even while you're pregnant, to explore, to like literally go physical places. When we were in your shoes, we were traveling to Costa Rica and traveling to places to figure out like
Canada. Oh, dodge that bullet.
We Canada was on our list of places.
Yeah, mine too. I've always wanted to live in Canada, but like if you talk to the people who are up there or you just go to the grocery store and you see what things cost.
Yeah.
Forget
I know.
It.
And,
you know,
and New Zealand
we were just in
too.
Canada to apply for the right to ask for a building permit that may or may not be granted.
Oh my God.
There's a development fee that's ranges from $15,000 to $60,000 just to maybe get a building permit.
Oh,
that's
my God.
Disgusting.
No,
that's
it's
horrible.
Gross. Yeah. So I'm like, we've dodged the bullet with that one, but be exploring, go get out there now. Well, you guys have your honeymoon. It was like partially our honeymoon was checking out places to go. And we decided against Costa Rica for various reasons, but you got to go in person and just like feel out the vibes, meet the people, see if you can make connections, decide where you want to you know, even if it's a place you just don't buy property at, but just go back to at regular intervals, then it can be kind of like, you know, a home away from home type thing. So
right.
You guys will do great. This was fun. Thanks.
Great. Yeah. Thank you.